Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Franchise Interviews, where we're asking the franchisepreneur who owns one. I'm your host, Marty McDermott, with my co-host, Don Johnson. And if you've ever dreamed about one day owning your own business, then you've come to the right place. We have a great show this morning. We're meeting with another fabulous Snell & Wilmer attorney, Holly Shilliday, who has loads of helpful information to share with our listeners on a real timely topic. Given today's economic conditions, many businesses are heading into financial troubles, such as bankruptcy, and franchise systems are no exception. Holly will speak to our audience on how systems should prevent bankruptcy, protect their rights, and handle bankruptcy. Holly has represented and advised lenders and numerous franchisors in bankruptcy cases filed by franchisees and their guarantors, and that's coming up in segment two of Franchise Interviews. Our first segment today is being brought to you by Franchise Interviews LLC, and Franchise Interviews gives you an up-close and behind-the-scenes look at franchising and entrepreneurship through our website, franchiseinterviews.com, where you can hear and read interviews as well as get inside tips from some of the most successful sources in franchising. A weekly franchise radio show on Blog Talk Radio, where each week you get to hear a new interview with franchisors, franchisees, franchise authors, franchise experts, and franchise attorneys, and our monthly franchise newsletter, which is a must-read for anyone looking to buy a franchise. And don't forget to check out our new podcast, Great Quotes in Franchising. And Don, welcome back to another edition of Franchise Interviews. How's your week going, my friend?
Okay, going pretty well. How about yourself, Marty?
Beautiful weather out there today. Fall is definitely here, and it's hard to imagine. We're going into October, next week?
Right, where you are, you see the change in the leaves at all, the colors? Not really
where
I am.
It's beautiful, yeah. Not quite yet. I mean, they're changing, but, you know, October is really the month, you know, to come up here. It's really pretty that time of year, you know, so it's, but I feel it coming. But yeah, September just kind of flew by, didn't it?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's always kind of an interesting time of year. I always just have a lot of memories this time of the year of school and college and playing soccer and playing football out when I was younger in the streets with friends and so forth.
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting because we're near Lafayette College, you know, Don, so it's interesting seeing all the kids head back to school and stuff like that, and, you know, they look all motivated and excited, and, you know,
time of their lives.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's an exciting time of their lives, you know, so it is. I have a lot of good memories myself of, you know, September, so that's fantastic. Our last show, Don, we met with Linda Searless, who's the founder of the Baby Power concept, and Linda started the business in a church basement, and she turned it into a profitable franchise business, and she's rewarding a parent-child play experience to her clients. The business Baby Power is a program for children ages 6 months to 5 years, which would include us because we have kids in that range, and the mission to build a communication between families through the Baby Power program that lasts a lifetime. It was definitely an interesting type of show, and it was targeted, I think, more the mompreneurs. So you can say. What were your thoughts on last week?
I mean, obviously a very smart woman. I mean, real interesting mom and pop type of franchise is how I would put it. I mean, it's interesting how hands-on, you know, she is. And I was really impressed by her business instincts. I mean, she does so much herself to build up the business. And, you know, she does a lot of the work herself from helping people find their location and to even choose if that person is the right fit to be a franchisee.
Right,
and I thought it was you know, very helpful, you know, type of service for you know, for families and mothers, and you know, I think your wife you gave her a call right after the show, right?
She did, yeah. She got a lot of great free advice. So thanks, Linda, you know, for speaking to Connie. I think they spoke probably for like an hour on the phone, you know, and she gave a lot of great advice, you know, because our baby is approaching that 1-year-old mark. So I was really listening, you know, trying to get a lot of good tips, you know, because, again, this is our first baby, you know, so it was, and you know, you give me a lot of great tips on the show as well. But, yeah, it was, I thought it was very interesting. She had a great quote from the show. It says, if Linda could give advice to other women thinking about starting their own business, she would say, if you love the business, then do it, but be prepared to work harder than you ever have before in your life. Right. Once a dreamer, she believes her life has tracked a song she wrote that states, go to sleep and dream of what you want to be. Go to sleep and dream, remember what you see. And I wasn't going to sing that, by the way. After all, you can dream it, then you can do it. You know, and I think we've kind of like the motivation for today, you know. But
we kidded her about she should write a book, and she said she's already, you know, on that path, I guess.
Yeah, and she really should, you know. I mean, that's the market is definitely big enough. And, you know, it's just so much information, you know, and you know this, when you have kids today, you know, I think there's just too much information, you know. And I really liked her whole philosophy as far as what she's doing with her franchise. And, yeah, it is interesting how she's very hands-on, you know. And, again, as the franchise grows, you know, it's going to be a little more difficult for her. And they're actually moving into Singapore. Could you imagine that? That's like their next franchise. So
I mean, early child development is so important. My twins just started their second year of preschool, and you know, we went last night to the school and talked to the teacher, and I guess it's so important, these early years development. And, and I know
that's what I've always read too, is that, you know, the early years, you know, the first like 5 years or 6 years are just really so important, you know. So but it was a good show, you know, and we're going to have to, as always, you know, keep watching them. You know, it's always interesting to have the newer franchise concepts on the show, you know, and watch how, you know, some of these things just grow. It's just amazing. A couple things, Don. I had, I don't know if you watched, you probably didn't have time this morning, putting on your suit and tie. Cartridge World was on Good Morning America. It was about 8:45, and it was a nice plug for Cartridge World. We've had them on the show twice up to this point. We had Gregory Carafello the first time, and it was on August 16th, I guess, of, I can't even remember, I guess it was last year. We had Jeff Beer and Norm Friedman, and you can actually hear that show if you go to franchiseinterviews.com and go to show descriptions and go down to August 16th, and I think that'll actually take you to gofranchise.com as well, where you can hear the whole show. But very fantastic franchise. I mean, we've been following Cartridge World for a while now as well, and they're just exceptional. I mean, their growth has been tremendous, and, you know, this whole green thing, you know, taking off and people becoming a lot more environmentally conscious, and people looking to save money as well. I think Cartridge World saves you about 30% on
– it's a big saving. We use their service as well, and I've seen their growth. We've financed people, and – you know, solid track record, you know, and a lot of our lending sources are very favorable towards Cartridge World, so I'm not surprised they're getting all that press.
Right, absolutely. So we'll have to have them back on sometime in 2009 as well, as we watch those guys continue to grow. Here's a definition from Joe Matthews, author of Street Smart Franchising, and we had Joe on our show probably about a year and a half ago, and he was just an incredible guest. He defines franchising, and there's a lot of different definitions for franchising, but he says the franchise relationship is grounded in a sacred trust, and I think that's a very powerful word, sacred trust, and mutual respect between franchisees and franchisors. Each has a mission, critical job to do. Each greatly impacts the other. Like combat soldiers in a platoon, franchisees and franchisors completely depend on each other to execute their jobs well to ensure mutual survival. I just thought that was very powerful, using that word sacred trust, you know, and mutual respect, because I think really that's what franchising is, you know. I mean, sometimes you'll see it as defined as like a legal relationship, and but you and I have gone as far on the show as, you know, defining it as a marriage, you know, and
partnership and marriage,
absolutely, you know. I mean, I think it's really, you know, almost that big. So just thought that was a great definition. I know you had some interesting articles.
Yeah, a few things. First, Marty, remember next week we'll just mention a couple of shows coming up. William Fleichman from I Sold It franchise. That's October 2nd. October 9th, Peter Baldeen of Moran Industries.
That's right.
Interesting automotive concepts, and I'll be talking shortly about an article in the automotive industry.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know, future shows, we're having the Entrepreneur Source, a very successful franchise consulting franchise.
Right.
Other shows, Business Partner, The Core, and You.
There's a lot of them, I mean, it's an interesting, you know, some very familiar concepts, and there's some new concepts as well. You know, I think Cousin Subs might be one of them in December.
Right.
And
Valpak,
Valpak. I mean, then we got Superior Wash in the beginning of January. I think that's the first show of the year. So some very interesting and exciting concepts. A lot of diversity over the next 4 to 5 months, you know. So
that's what we're trying to do. A lot of information, help a lot of people out there nationwide, introduce them to different concepts, and and just the whole process of franchising.
And I think that's what people like most about the show, Don, you know, is, I mean, we really talk about everything. I think we give the diversity, you know. And, again, we talk about, as you and I mentioned, like the good, bad, and the ugly, you know. I mean, a lot of times we'll mention to people that, you know, franchising is not for everybody. In fact, it's probably not for most people. As much as you and I are very pro-franchise, you know, and we believe in franchising, again, it isn't for everybody. And, you know, we kind of give both sides of the story, you know, so this way people or our listeners can make a very informed decision.
It's like today's show, having Holly Schilladay talking about unfortunately situations when there's bankruptcies or just bad situations between the franchisor and franchisee. So she'll be talking a little bit about that today, and that's coming up. And I just want to mention quickly, October 18th and 19th, there's a franchise show out on Long Island, New York, Marty. It's going to be at Suffolk County College Saturday and Sunday. People wanting information, go to longislandfranchiseexpo.com, and that's October 18th and 19th. I think there'll be over 60 franchise companies represented at that show.
And the small ones are great, Don, too, I think. I mean, you and I have been to some smaller franchise shows. You know, a lot of times you and I are used to going to the big ones and, like, the convention centers. And, again, those are great. But, you know, the smaller ones I find sometimes could be a little more intimate, you know, where you actually get to spend a lot of time talking to the franchisor. So I think people in that area, if you're interested in franchising, to take advantage of it.
Exactly. Good. Here's something, Marty, interesting. Through the Associated Press, still close to the vest, KFC is shoring up security for 68-year-old secret recipe. That's out of my local paper, the Asbury Park Press here in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And this is through Louisville, Kentucky. It starts off, Marty, the secret's out at KFC. Well, sort of. Colonel Harlan Sanders' handwritten recipe of 11 herbs and spices was removed Tuesday from safekeeping at KFC's corporate offices for the first time in decades. The temporary relocation is allowing KFC to revamp security around the yellowing sheet of paper that contains one of the country's most famous corporate secrets. The brand's top executive admitted his nerves were a flutter despite the tight security he lined up for the operation. He says, "I don't want to be the president who loses the recipe." KFC president Roger Eaton says, "Imagine how terrifying that would be." The recipe that launched the chicken chain was placed in a lockbox and was handcuffed to security expert Bo Deitel, who climbed aboard an armored car that whisked away with an escort from off-duty police officers. Eaton's parting words to Deitel, "Keep it safe." Man, a lot of emotions going up with this secret recipe here.
It's incredible. I've told students this story before, and a lot of them don't even believe it, you know, but I think it makes it even more appealing to KFC that, you know, they treat the recipe in this manner, you know, that it's handwritten from Colonel Sanders on a yellow piece of paper. I mean, it's just
important franchising history. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So important is the 68-year-old concoction that coats the chain's original recipe chicken that only two company executives at any time have access to it. The company refuses to release their names or titles, and it uses multiple suppliers who produce and blend the ingredients but know only a part of the entire contents. Deitel, a former New York City police detective, assured Eaton that the iconic recipe would be safe. "There's no way, shape, or form that anybody's going to get their hands on this recipe," he said. "If they get their hands on this recipe, they have to take me with them."
Wow, that's dedication, huh?
That's the guy I want protecting me someday.
Oh, absolutely.
The security firm is also handling security improvements for the recipe at headquarters, but he wouldn't say what changes they're making. KFC executives said they decided to upgrade security after retrieving the recipe amid preparations to add a new line of original recipe chicken strips. The recipe has been stashed at the company headquarters for decades. For more than 20 years, has been tucked away in a filing cabinet equipped with two combination locks. To reach the cabinet, the keepers of the recipe would first open a vault and unlock three locks on a door that stood in front of the cabinet.
Wow.
Vials of the herbs and spices are also stored in the secret filing cabinet. "The smell is overwhelming when you open it," said one of the two keepers of the recipe. The biggest prize, though, is a single sheet of notebook paper yellowed by age that lays out the entire formula, including exact amounts for each ingredient. And it goes on here. Yada, yada. I guess Sanders developed the formula in 1940 at his tiny restaurant in southeastern Kentucky and used it to launch the KFC chain in the early 1950s. He died in 1980, as we talked about past shows, but his likeness is still central to KFC's marketing. "The recipe to him in later years was everything he stood for," said Shirley Kottmiller, his personal secretary for about 12 years.
That's a great story, isn't it? I mean, they just, KFC, they're so clever with their marketing, you know. It's, you know, we've had a lot of great stories about KFC over the last 2 years. You know, one of my favorites with them, I don't know if you remember this one, we actually used to have it on our homepage of franchiseinterviews.com, was when they did their new logo. And you can actually see it from space. I don't know if you remember that one. And you said, who's looking at it, you know? And but the whole thing was they just got so much PR on it. I mean, it was in, you know, every major newspaper in the United States, and there was a picture of it, you know, and it was up on our website. And it's just, they're very clever, you know, the way they go about these things, you know? And that's interesting. But it's a great story, though. It's a lot of fun.
Definitely. Here's something from the Restaurant Finance Monitor, Marty, by the Franchise Times Magazine, their newsletter. Franchise Times Magazine recently completed its annual Franchise Times 200 report. The usual mega franchise companies like McDonald's, KFC, Burger King, Subway, Pizza Hut, Wendy's, Taco Bell, Tim Hortons, Domino's, and Dunkin' Donuts, of course, made the top list. The monitor took the Franchise Times data one step further and compared 81 companies, now these are all restaurants, of course, in the 2007 report to the data that was reported in the 2000 version. So they kind of made a comparison of 5 years apart and a couple interesting stats. One, I guess, it says here, big-time growth at Jimmy John's. According to their computations, the fastest-growing franchise restaurant chain over the past 5 years was Jimmy John's Gourmet Sandwich Shops.
Wow.
Sandwich shop chain owned by the entrepreneur Jimmy John Littaud and the private equity firm is also involved, but they grew from $67 million in sales in 2002 to $386 million in 2007, an increase of over 570%.
That's incredible. Do you have any Jimmy John's near you, or have you been to one?
I've financed a few, but I've never.
You have? I've worked with them many years ago, Franchise America, but and there is one actually, I think it's in Easton, and I've passed it a couple of times, but never got in there. I really have to go in there because that growth is that's incredible.
Right. Well, they went from 167 restaurants in 2002 to over to 632 by the end of 2007. So big time
growth
for them. The fastest growing restaurant chains sales percent: one Jimmy John's, two Cold Stone Creamery, then you have Wingstop, Qdoba, Buffalo Wild Wings, Zaxby's, Tim Hortons, McAllister's Deli, Panera Bread, coming in at 9, and then Quiznos at number 10.
Wow.
It says here, sales growth, I guess, greater than a billion. And, you know, some of the big, you know, the biggies we mentioned before, like Subway, McDonald's, KFC, also Dunkin' Donuts, Pizza Hut, Chili's, Sonic Drive-In, Domino's Pizza, Wendy's, Quiznos, Applebee's, and Chick-fil-A.
Wow.
So
that's incredible.
Yeah, and it looks like this restaurant Qdoba looks like it's doing pretty well with you know, percentage growth, and Wingstop, Zaxby's. It's always interesting stats to see which franchise systems are having success.
The competition's so intense too, isn't it, Don? I mean, you know, some of these names that you just kind of threw out. You know, I mean, it's just that industry. I mean, wow, you're talking major competition.
Right. And just one last thing, I guess I see here Baskin-Robbins, who we had on the show a couple months ago, they having some nice growth. They went from over 4,700 open locations nationwide to over 5,800. So
wow, good for them.
Doing well. Here's something also in the Franchise Times Magazine, Auto Industry Drivers Wanted Now by Jonathan Mays. Is this a good time to be in the business of fixing cars? Well, that depends. How does that half-filled glass look? For the glass have full crowd, there is this reason for optimism. People are driving older cars. Auto sales have fallen like a brick over the last several months, taking with them not just domestic automakers hurting from lower SUV sales, but also the import companies like Toyota, known more for gas-sipping models. Fewer new cars on the road means more older cars on the road, and more older cars means more business. Yet the pessimists may have an even more notable number. The number of miles driven in the U.S. has fallen each of the past 6 months. That is hurting an industry generally considered recession-proof by keeping cars off the road. Cars that aren't driven as much don't wear out as quickly. The number of miles driven has been declining for the last 6 months, says Mike Rippey, CEO of 1-800-Radiator, who we had on recently, a California-based wholesale radiator franchise. That's never happened before, he says. The effect is, across all auto parts, if a car is driven less, it takes longer for parts to wear out. Makes sense.
It does make sense, yeah.
It goes on, which of you is winning out? So far, it appears that the pessimists have it. While some companies have reported strong sales recently, many others have shown weakness and stock prices for several of them have fallen. That makes sense. For years, the auto industry has been able to rely on a simple fact. People keep driving. Miles traveled had been increasing steadily since the early 80s when gas prices began falling after the previous price spike of the late 70s. The recent declines have followed the run-up in gas prices. Most recently, the number of miles driven in the U.S. fell 3.7% in May, according to the Federal Highway Administration. That continued a steady, significant decline that began in November. More people are using mass transit, which has increased significantly in many markets, and the popularity of gas-sipping vehicles like scooters has also increased. The decreased driving does have a ripple effect on aftermarket companies that deal in both service issues and parts sales, Marty. For instance, if people are driving less, they may take 4 months to need an oil change instead of three. It may take them a year to need a maintenance checkup instead of 9 months. It says there's a domino effect, says Sid Wilson, senior analyst with Kevin, Dan, and Partners, who focuses on the auto aftermarket industry. Now that six-month repair takes 8 months, something you need it every 9 months takes 12 months. It has, of course, an impact on the whole industry.
Right, right. That's interesting. I didn't, you know, and I didn't think about that when we had Kelly Grace of 1-800-RAD-8 on the show.
Right.
You know, he said that people are keeping their autos a lot longer, you know, with
right.
the economy being the way it is, you know. So over time, there are parts that will have to be replaced, radiators being one of them. You know, I think it's every 7 years you change a radiator, so it does make sense, you know. I mean, again, I guess there's good and bad with certain industries as the economy is the way it is today.
As many people are delaying repairs on cars for economic concerns, we do believe that gas prices are causing some drivers to simply defer major repairs and seek alternative transportation, said
right.
Todd Left, chief executive of AMCO Transmission. In the current environment, companies do well when they have high margins, which enable them to underprice their competitors. And service companies do well when they offer something of value. Companies like Texas-based Christian Brothers Automotive, which lures customers with a clean, customer-friendly environment that targets mostly women.
Hmm.
And it says here, this is interesting, Americans bought 13.6 million new cars in May. That's down 18% from the same period a year ago, according to the industry research firm Auto
wow.
Data. The worst drop since October of 2002 was that decline in auto sales.
That's something. That's pretty significant, 18% in that industry. You know, that's a lot. It's does that mean you're going to be driving to work on a scooter?
I've already looked into it. Online.
There you go.
I've ordered two.
There you go.
It just says, while that means cars today are more reliable, that still means people are holding on to their cars longer. As the average age of an auto gets older, they fail more often, Rippey said, and while people can
right.
put off car repairs, they can't put them off forever. If a radiator starts to go, they can keep putting water in the thing for 4 or 5 months, he said, but eventually you'll have to pay the piper.
That's great. That's an interesting article.
Yeah.
So good articles today. Well, the show today, Don, is being brought to you by Franchise Interviews, LLC, and Franchise Interviews gives you an up-close and behind-the-scenes look at franchising and entrepreneurship through our website, franchiseinterviews.com, where you can hear and read interviews, as well as get insight tips from some of the most successful sources in franchising. Our weekly franchise radio show on Blog Talk Radio, each week you get to hear a new interview with franchisors, franchisees, franchise authors, franchise experts, and franchise attorneys, and our monthly franchise newsletter, which is a must-read for anyone looking to buy a franchise. And don't forget to check out our Great Quotes in Franchising podcast. And as we were saying earlier, Don, we have a great show today. We're meeting with another fabulous Snell & Wilmer attorney, Holly Shilliday, who has loads of helpful information to share with our audience on a real timely topic, especially what we're talking about today. Given today's economic conditions, many businesses are heading into financial troubles, such as bankruptcy, and franchise systems are unfortunately no exception. And Holly's going to speak to our audience on how systems can prevent bankruptcy. She's got a lot of great tips, protect their rights, and also handle bankruptcy. You know, God forbid it occurs. Hey, Holly, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good Oops. Morning, guys. How are you?
Good, Holly. How you doing today?
Doing well, thank you. I
That's
have an
great.
Older car, by the way, 2001.
There you go. So you confirmed our articles. That's great.
And keep pumping water in your radiator when it gets low.
Yeah, there you go.
What?
Yeah. Holly, Will's like to start off asking our guests where they're calling from today.
I'm in Littleton, Colorado today, and it's a beautiful blue sky. It's going to be about 80.
I imagine. Yeah, it's interesting because as long as Don and I, we've been doing this show 2 years now, Holly. I think it seems like it's the capital, doesn't it, Don, for franchising?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing how many. I'm saying we're going to have to eventually move our offices out there at some point.
Yeah.
Perfect.
You know? Yeah. Holly, with the economy the way it is today, what trends are you seeing today with respect to franchise systems? In other words, have you seen an increase in the amount of bankruptcy situations or a decrease in the amount of new franchise sales?
You know, that's a good question. And you would think that there would be an increase in bankruptcies, but actually there isn't. But I can tell you that there's an increase in franchise failures. A lot of times the businesses don't even bother with the bankruptcy part of it. They go ahead and go dark. And if we're seeing bankruptcies at all, it's by the principal of the company, because the principal is typically the person who guarantees, you know, the franchise agreement, the lease, the equipment loan. So they're the ones that are trying to get the bankruptcy relief. But generally, I'm noticing that sales are down, you know, costs of goods are up, franchisees are unable to locate new money to continue their business operations, and so that's why we're not really seeing any reorganization. They're just businesses going dark.
That's interesting.
Talking about franchisees and franchisors, there's actually been an increase in franchisor bankruptcies. I'm sure you've probably already talked about the parent company of Bennigan's and Steak and Ale filing. There was Village Inn, Ground Round. There's been some big ones in the past, and
Right. Some
of them are successful and some of them are not.
What's usually the reason for that happening? Just poor, you know, just overall poor management, or they weren't able to change with the times? Marty and I reached, go over a lot of the shows talking about how franchisors updating their look and their system is, I mean, is that really, what's happening a lot of times when these companies are going under, Holly?
I do believe so. I think a lot of the systems may be dated, and if they don't keep up with the times, the sales fall off, and it's hard to generate new franchisees. Sometimes there's too much growth. You have too many of them in the system, and it's kind of hard to handle that growth. And, you know, there's a number of factors. Right now, I think the economy is playing a big role in franchise failures.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah, it was interesting. The ones that you mentioned, Holly, you know, I mean, these were ones that I frequented, you know, 20 years ago, you know, like your, you know, Steak and Ale and Ground Round, you know, I miss some of those places, you know. But I think, as you were saying, Don, I think a lot of them probably haven't changed with the times, you know, and
right.
I think that was one part of it. So that is interesting.
Yeah,
the other thing is
sometimes.
Right.
The Ground Round. I went there as a kid, and you'd love to, you know, be able to take your kids there one day. It's just sad sometimes, but
right.
You know, I guess that's business. That's the way of the world, but it's always unfortunate.
And Ground Round is still around. I think
right. More
probably on the East Coast than out here, but
right.
You know, it definitely has had its problems in the past. The other thing I'm noticing is that there's a decrease in new franchise sales. But on the flip side, there seems to be an increase in existing franchise transfers. And I think a lot of that is because the franchisors don't like to report a failure or one of their locations going dark. So it's better to find a new operator to go in and to keep the location going.
That's interesting. And they don't want this thing showing up in their the franchise disclosure document, Holly, I guess, right? It's kind of like
That's right. The reporting is brutal in the you know, I'm sure this year, looking at the filings, you're going to see a lot of new listings for the failures and for bankruptcies and lawsuits.
Right, that's interesting.
And that trickles down to when a franchisee is reviewing that franchisor for investment. I'm involved in franchise financing, Holly, so, you know, our lenders more than ever are looking at the default rate, the failure rate of certain franchise systems, and I've witnessed more franchisors taking over that
right. Failing
franchisee just to not avoid having a default or a failure. We've helped a lot of people to buy a franchise from corporate that initially was with a franchisee. So, it's harder for people to get financing when that default rate is high. So franchisors are smart to kind of take that approach.
Yeah, and I think that lenders are smart too, and they're looking at the type of franchise that their customers want to open and deciding if it's something that they want to invest in. There's definitely, good franchise systems and not so good franchise systems, and the lenders need to be a part of that that process.
Interesting,
So staying with, the topic of bankruptcy in its various forms, let's begin with preventing bankruptcy. What are some of the warning signs that a franchisor should look for, Holly?
You know, to me, the number one sign is when a franchisee stops communicating, and that's with the lender, with the franchisor, with the landlord.
Right.
Also, failure to pay royalties or advertising fees. If there's revolving door management, meaning they can't keep someone in charge, delinquent taxes. I think if there's an increase in complaints regarding a franchise, that's a good sign that something is going on. And then another thing I was thinking about was if they're suddenly paying COD, that means that they've probably not paid a lot of their vendors. So those are probably the best warning signs of something's going wrong.
Right.
Interesting.
What happens when a, say it just happened to me, just recently, a franchise, someone's, coming to us for financing. They already paid the franchise fees, and now the franchisor system just dissolved. They're no longer operating. So what happens? So, that person, I guess, their franchise fee is, possibly not, might not get it back. But what about the existing franchisees who are part of a dissolved franchise system? What do they keep doing? Do they still keep those vendor and supplier relationships to keep their business going under the same name?
Yes, I think that's right. There are protections under the bankruptcy code, at least if the franchisor files bankruptcy, for those who are have franchise agreements or license agreements. And so, although there's power of the debtor to reject and assume contracts, if the debtor is actually the licensor, there are things in the code that will protect the licensee. But interestingly, in, say, the Bennigan's case, it looks like some franchisees may be taking over 40 to 60 of the company-owned operated restaurants. So I think that what we're going to see is kind of a flip where the franchisees own the system, the marks, and everything, and continue on the brand even, after the bankruptcy filing. So it's not impossible, but if the franchise system doesn't file bankruptcy, basically the franchisee has a claim against the franchisor and can sue them on that claim. But one of the big things we say in our business is you can't get blood out of a turnip. So if they have no assets or nothing to go after, you're basically going to get a judgment on a piece of paper that's suitable for framing.
That's something. And this is why the trust and communication and honesty, I guess, are so important, when we're talking about franchising, Holly. So you can kind of avoid these things happening, I guess the frequent communication with your franchisees, I guess, is one way to kind of prevent something like this from happening.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if everyone's honest about what's going on and keep those lines of communications open, the parties are more willing to work together.
Right.
And, I think to start off with, it's good to look at who the parties are that you're dealing with when you have a troubled franchise. First, you have, of course, the franchisee. Second, the landlord, who's an important player in this, the franchisor,
right.
And also the lender. And the failure to work with any one of these parties typically results in a failed franchise. And what I mean by that is you can enter into a restructuring agreement with your lender to try to work things out, but that's not going to work. It won't survive if the franchisor decides to go ahead and terminate the franchise agreement or if the landlord evicts the franchisee. So that's why you kind of have to all work together of the common goal of keeping this franchise afloat.
That's interesting. So what happens if it's too late, Holly? Like, in other words, let's say that someone's listening to this program, they're realizing that they've overlooked the warning signs and they know their franchisee is beyond help. What do they do then?
That's a great question. I think first, before we get to that point, I want to talk a little bit about what can be done to, bring things back on track.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience is that franchisors oftentimes will give a break on the royalties or the license fees. Either they will reduce them or they will enter into a forbearance agreement where they'll give the franchisee time to, pay back the fees over time. The other thing that a franchisor can do is put together a team And this is like a team of operations people or asked a successful franchisee to assist a troubled franchisee to identify and deal with operational issues. You can make allowances for marketing. In extreme circumstances, consider relocating the franchise. That probably only works if the franchisor is the landlord.
Right.
So, you know, again, if there's communication, then they're more likely to work with you. And that's really the same with lenders, because if the site ends up going dark, unless they have the real estate, the lender's likely to receive pennies on the dollar if they're forced to liquidate the personal property assets. So in a lot of times our lenders are saying it's better to restructure and give them a second chance. So when we get to the point where it's too late and the trust is gone, really there's two options. One is to try to find a new franchisee to take over the location. And if you're not able to do that, then I say quickly terminate the license. Typically, the license agreements are going to have provisions where you know, you're going to be in a position to terminate it. So follow the license agreement and the law applicable to the state to the letter, and go ahead and get that license agreement terminated. And what I mean by that is sometimes you have a license agreement that says you have 30 days, so you have to give them the 30-day notice and give them an opportunity to cure. A lot of times you see provisions that are an automatic termination, but just make sure you do it right, because the last thing you want to do is end up in a bankruptcy case where that franchise agreement is still sitting out there.
Now, what happens if the franchisee files bankruptcy?
Well, first of all, there's going to be three types of bankruptcies that could possibly occur with a franchisee: a Chapter 7 liquidation, a Chapter 13 reorganization, and a Chapter 11 reorganization. So the first thing that happens when a bankruptcy is filed is there's an automatic stay that's in place that prohibits creditors from taking action against the debtor or against property of the state. And just to give you a precursor, a license agreement that has not been properly terminated is property of the state. So you can't take any action with respect to that license agreement once the case has been filed. So the bankruptcy process is supposed to give a breathing spell to the debtor. So Chapter 7 liquidation, you actually have a trustee that's appointed in the case, and the trustee is responsible for taking possession of all the non-exempt assets and to liquidate them for the benefit of the creditors. And a lot of times, you know, you would think that it would happen instantly, file the bankruptcy and the trustee goes in and takes over operations, but that's not typically the case. Usually, if it's a Chapter 7, the business is already dark. The trustee takes some time before getting in there and before examining the debtor and the books and records. And oftentimes, it just passes through bankruptcy because a secured lender, basically gets everything at the end of the day. So there's nothing for the trustee to do. And that's what when we talk about non-exempt assets, they also have to be unsecured assets. And so that's really a rarity. In a Chapter 11 case, the franchisee remains in possession of the assets, typically continues to operate the business, and the ultimate goal is to propose a plan of reorganization that's going to be voted upon by the creditors. And it's also possible to have a Chapter 11 liquidating case, and that's really the most common type of case we're seeing these days. If you look at Sharper Image, Bombay Club, probably even Bennigan's, that's the state is just to sell everything. Sue people for preferences and fraudulent conveyances, and then distribute whatever's left after payment of attorneys to the unsecured creditors. So the debtor in the Chapter 11 we call the debtor in possession. The other type of bankruptcy is a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, and that's typically for an individual who is reorganizing, and we're seeing guarantors that are filing Chapter 13s. There are strict debt limits and asset limits in those cases, and what we're finding is a lot of times the guarantor is actually above those limits, but they also don't qualify for a Chapter 7. I don't know if you guys know, but back in 2005, it was in the papers, there's a change in the bankruptcy laws, so it actually makes it a little more difficult to file bankruptcy.
Right.
But that hasn't stopped the huge increase in bankruptcy filings this year. I think we're up like 28%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you know what percentage, Holly, companies that file Chapter 11 end up coming out of bankruptcy and just
Extremely rare. Fewer than 10%, I would say.
Oh, my God.
So, well, the interesting thing is a lot of times the agreement, the license agreement, provides that the filing of a bankruptcy by the guarantor is an automatic default of the franchise agreement. And so in that case, the franchisor can actually terminate the franchise agreement even though the company is not otherwise in default. And we saw that happen a lot after the change in the law in 2005 when guarantors decided, you know, I'm gonna go ahead and file. I don't want to have this potential liability in the future. So I actually had clients that terminated the license agreements of the businesses based on the guarantor file. So, but the next step in the bankruptcy is that the bankruptcy case creates the bankruptcy estate, which consists of all the assets. And that's all defined by state law. And you look and see what the assets are as of the date of the filing. So if the franchise agreement was properly terminated before the petition date, then and the debtor no longer has a right to cure, then that franchise agreement will not become property of the estate. The franchisor may have to work with making sure that the franchisee no longer is using the marks, making sure you get back all that confidential trade secret information, but otherwise you're pretty much done in the process except for filing a proof of claim, which basically sets forth how much this debtor owes you, and perhaps in the future you'll get some money out of the case. But, you know, it's a different situation if you didn't terminate or if the termination was not proper, because then you could get into a battle with the debtor over whether or not that license agreement becomes property of the estate. So you could ask the court to lift the stay if it's a real burden on the franchisor in order to go ahead and get it terminated. But typically, the judges are going to give the debtor some time to try to get all their assets and all their business affairs in order to confirm a plan. So anyway, you have this franchise agreement, and it's kind of interesting what can go on with it in the bankruptcy case. So the first thing is that the debtor can reject the franchise agreement, which means they no longer want to perform their side of the deal. And if that's the case, if it gets rejected, then it's basically done. You revert back to state law, and the franchisor has a claim in the bankruptcy case. But the franchisor may also assume the license agreement. And in order to assume a license agreement or a franchise agreement, the franchisee is going to have to cure all the defaults in order to remain a part of that franchise agreement. So oftentimes there's a dispute among the franchisor and the franchisee about how much money it's going to cost to cure the defaults under the agreement. And, you know, you could have litigation over that. I had a case in Massachusetts where it ended up being the biggest issue of the case, and ultimately the franchise system ended up not successfully assuming those agreements. But, yeah, the real interesting thing is that a franchisee could assume the contract and then assign it to a third party. Wow. So if you're a franchisor, you're like, what, a third party? That's not who I contracted with. There are some protections in the code, like, the third party has to prove that they, you know, adequate assurance of future performance, might have to turn over their financials, and, and there's a split in the circuits about whether or not a third party can assume one of these license agreements. There's a Burger King case, for example, that said, come on, there's thousands of Burger Kings across the nation. It doesn't take specialized knowledge. It's not a personal services contract.
Right.
You know, plenty of people can go in here and operate it, so we're going to go ahead and allow the assumption. So it's pretty interesting, but in reality, we're not seeing that many, franchise bankruptcies. But the good news is I am seeing a lot more workouts by lenders, and I think that's promising. I think that lenders, franchisors, not necessarily landlords, they seem to have the most powerful position, but they know that it's not going to be good if this business goes dark. And so they're willing to sit down and work something out, whether you re-amortize the loan, you know, have an interest-only period, a forbearance agreement. A lot of times our lenders are allowing the franchisee time to find a new buyer to come in. And they're accepting short sales if it makes sense. But oftentimes as well, they have guarantees and guarantors on the hook. So they're going to look to the guarantor to, you know, maybe not make them 100% whole, but to at least contribute to the outcome. So it's very interesting.
So all this being discussed, Holly, all really goes back to, like, initially when an investor or potential franchisee is making their decision. One, you have to make sure that, you know, you're going to be able to make the investment and have cash reserve, and if you're getting financing to get working capital and to get interest only for a few months, and all these things are so crucial starting a new business. Then the other side of the coin is, of course, to just make sure that you're not making a bad decision on a franchise system. So what would you, recommend to someone, to invest their potential franchisee, to maximize their chance that they're not making a wrong decision, that they're making a right decision on a franchise?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think that you really have to do your homework. You have to look at, I would look at the number of failures, the number of lawsuits, how aggressive this franchisor is with respect to when their franchises fail. And, you know, look at the age of it. Go for something that you like. I look out, like, for example, I mean, I don't even know if Build-A-Bear franchises. I think they may, but look at Build-A-Bear. Like, wow, I wish I would have thought of that.
Right, that's true.
But part of it, it's probably better to get in early on a good franchise than it is to get in later, because the early part of the system, the royalty fees aren't so, you know, high at that point.
Right.
It's later on down the line when the franchise has success that they raise the royalty fees. And the terms may be a little more onerous than at the beginning of the system. It's definitely a difficult process, but you have to look at everything.
That's a very tough decision. You know, so what do you do if you're investing earlier and the franchise is younger? Might be more opportunity, more room for growth. Like you said, the lower royalty fees, but and at the same time, there could be more risk because it is a newer system.
I think the bottom line is that
Marty and I have stressed this all throughout a couple years of doing the show, is just make sure you're lining yourself up with specialists like yourself, a franchise consultant who can help them with all the choices out there, and have an attorney to make sure you're reviewing the franchise agreement, the FDD. We've even had someone on to discuss information about the lease and all the negotiation that goes on there. So these are all such critical decisions in your business venture.
I think that's exactly right. And actually, I've had this experience happen within the last few months where it was a franchise-owned store, and someone came in and took over the operation, but the franchise failed to inform them that there was a lien on all of the furniture, fixtures, and equipment. And so a guy comes in, he's been operating it for 6 months, and suddenly lender's saying, hey, pay up for my stuff or turn it over to me.
Oh my God.
And I have to think that the person who stepped into that situation just didn't realize that there were other pieces of the puzzle.
Right.
You know, they thought, oh, I get the space, I get everything in it. You know, and
right.
I'm sure that the franchisor, their documentation probably said otherwise. But that just goes to show you why it's good to have a good consultant or an attorney or someone to advise you with respect to starting up a franchise.
How long do these disputes last, Holly? I mean, can some of them last years, the ones that you've worked on?
Which kind of dispute?
I guess anything in general between a franchisee or franchisor, if they're not coming to an agreement on a particular issue.
It depends on the franchisor.
Mm-hmm.
I have a workout going on right now with it's probably like a 36 unit franchise where I represent the lender, and they have a dispute with their franchisor over advertising. And that dispute has probably been going on for 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a threat of we're going to close you down And then there was a forbearance period. And so we're just waiting to see what happens, because whether or not we take the next step and restructure this debt depends on if there's going to be something to restructure at the end of the day. So some franchisors are very quick.
Right.
You know, we send out your default notice. You didn't cure. You're done. File the lawsuit.
Exactly.
You know,
there's more mediation, I guess, going on, Holly, than in the past.
There's definitely. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about you know, having a mediator, and I guess is used as another option.
Yeah, mediators can be good depending on the situation. Most of the time, mediators come in once there's been a lawsuit filed, and by that time, the franchisor or the lender has decided we're done, we're pulling the plug. It might be a good idea to get someone in before that time. You know, I end up being on long conference calls where we're trying to work it out, where everyone's giving their position, and we see if we can come to an agreement. But, you know, there's parties that have more power than other parties. And typically that's a franchisor and the lender. But it's good for the franchisee to understand, you know, how it works and what the dynamics are when they're going into a workout situation with the franchisor and with the lender. You know, threatening bankruptcy, I've heard that for 16 years. You know, that's not much of a threat to me, and that's only going to aggravate the situation. So I wouldn't run in there and just say, hey, you know, we're filing, you can't do anything about it. I'd have a little more of an attitude of, hey, you know, what can we do to get the situation turned around? We would really like to, or we would like to find the buyer. A lot of times the franchisors are good at locating someone, you know, but keep the communication open, and that's going to be the best result for everyone, because if you just allow it to go dark, you know, the franchisor or the lender or the landlord, they're all going to go after you, after the principal who guaranteed everything, and you know, could potentially force a bankruptcy. And no one wants to file bankruptcy. I mean, that's not the goal.
Right.
That was interesting how you say there's less franchisor bankruptcies, but there's been more franchise systems failing. You know, a lot of those older or newer systems, or is it a mixed bag of franchise systems going under?
You know, it's mixed. We're seeing both old and new. And, I mean, you have to look at the cost of fuel, the sale of goods. If you look at restaurants, cheese, dairy, wheat, all of their costs of doing business have really gone up. And so it just makes it, they get to a point where they're like, you know, I'm tired of doing this for no profit. barely making ends meet. I'm dipping into my savings to make payroll or do whatever. And they just decide it's time to give up. I put up the white flag. You know, it's not necessarily just the older systems.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. We read a story, it was like about a month, it was probably about 2 months ago, Holly, about with the rising gas prices, you know, and all these delivery services, like these pizza places and Chinese restaurants. I mean, they're really feeling the pinch, you know. So there's just so many factors involved in all of this.
You know, customers,
or they'll just pass it on to the customer. Yeah.
I know, but don't the customers get angry?
Sure.
I can't tell you, having to pay like a resort fee at a hotel or an extra gas fee on a delivery just irritates me.
Exactly.
Or $25 to check in your luggage, you know.
Absolutely.
You can see your customers to death.
Oh, absolutely. Is there more disclosure, Holly, in the new, we have the shift from the UFOC to the FDD. Has there been any changes in the bankruptcy section for the FDD, or is that pretty much the same?
You know, there's a lot more detail. And it definitely, I think you have to put all the ones that have closed. You have to list all the bankruptcies. You have to list all the litigation. You have to list whether or not they settled.
Right.
I can't remember if you have to put the amount of the settlement agreement. I'm getting ready to assist in this process, you know, as we get ready to do the updates.
Make all
for
these
all
changes.
These
right. It sounds like there's more disclosure, with the FDD. I guess that was the biggest
shift. There's a lot more
shift.
Disclosure. And I think that works to the franchisee's benefit to a certain extent because the franchisor doesn't want to have five pages of disclosure on their problem children and the franchise systems.
So it's
better to come to an amicable resolution if possible.
Yeah, I agree. So what happens to the franchise agreement in bankruptcy, Holly?
Well, you know, you can either reject it, and then it's back to the state court. But by that time, the restaurant's probably dark. They've decided to close the location. You assume it, which means they want to continue on with the relationship, and you're going to have to wait through the Chapter 11 process and see if they can get a plan confirmed. And as we discussed already, it's extremely rare to confirm a plan of reorganization. And one of the big things today is it's hard to find money in order to keep the ship afloat, so to speak.
But during
the bankruptcy process, the franchisor could ask the bankruptcy court to order the franchisee to make adequate protection payments, which means, hey, if you're going to continue to use our mark, continue to use our system, we need to be protected during the bankruptcy case, so please, let's require this franchisee to go ahead and make those monthly payments. You know, we can worry about the back payments through the plan of reorganization, but it's killing us to have our system in this bankruptcy and we're not getting paid. So that's the assumption route, and then, of course, the assumption and the assignment to a third person. From time to time there's litigation in the bankruptcy court where, you know, the franchisee blames the franchisor for its woes. So you actually could have a lawsuit within the bankruptcy, saying that the franchisor engaged in some wrongdoing or the franchisor wrongfully terminated the agreement or didn't comply with the law when it terminated it. So there's a lot can happen. It's a very dynamic process. It's also a very expensive process, which is another reason why a lot of systems don't make it through the bankruptcy process. You know, if you had the money in the first place, you probably wouldn't need to file. No one really thinks about that it takes a lot of money to be in bankruptcy, especially in a Chapter 11 case. And a lot of that money gets eaten up by the administrative costs of the case.
This is all great information. It's just so crucial. Do you have any last words, Holly, of advice to our listeners?
Yeah, I do. And I think that really no franchisor wants to see one of its franchisees file bankruptcy because it negatively reflects upon the franchise system. But, you know, if they have a good relationship, then there's a chance that the franchisor is going to work with the franchisee to avoid bankruptcy, and the same goes true with the lender. And, you know, they might help them find a new franchisee to take over. They might work with them to figure out some operational issues, give them a break, and just basically help a franchisee who is experiencing difficulties. I've had some of my franchisors that end up doing settlement agreements where, they'll accept something less than the full amount owing in order to make things right. But if bankruptcy is inevitable, my advice is to make sure you act quickly and legally as a franchisor to enforce your rights and remedies under the license agreement before a bankruptcy case is filed, because that's going to be the cheapest way for the franchisor to get out. So I really think that the communication is the number one thing to take away from this, and that everyone needs to communicate, including the franchisor, the lessor, the franchisee, and the landlord, because that's really the only way you're going to survive the process when times are tough. And I think people are more willing to work now. So don't
stop
that line of
communication. It should be an interesting time for you. The next year, Holly, should be pretty interesting, the way the economy is. And,
yeah, busy.
I'm sure you're very busy.
I am swamped right now. But the good news is a lot of it is workout stuff. And
right.
I think people should take note of that there could be a way out if you just communicate.
Right.
That's great. We have about 60 seconds, Holly. What's the best way for our listeners to get more information on you and your services? Is there any like websites they can refer to? We have a link on our show page, actually, to your page on Snell & Wilmer, I think it is.
Oh, yeah, www.swlaw.com is our website. And, I mean, my number is 303-634-2087. And a lot of times I'm happy just to talk to someone for a few minutes if they have a question. And, you know, that's no charge there. But it's a very interesting time. And we'll just have to see what happens. I think it's going to be a year or two before we come out of this kind of economic mess, so to speak.
That's right.
So,
yeah,
thank
right.
you guys so much for having
thank
me.
Thank you, Holly. You're a fantastic
today.
Guest. It was a great topic, and it was a really perfect timing to do a show like this, you know. So we definitely love to have you back in the near future and talk about some more stuff just like this.
Definitely.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Holly.
Thanks, Holly. Have a great day today.
You too. Bye.
Take care.
Great topic, huh, Don?
Yeah, something that has to be discussed because, unfortunately, stuff like this happens, you know, whether it's due to the economy or poor management, whatever, there's always going to be, you know, situations like that.
Right. I mean, but again, as Ali was saying, you know, it sounds like the key is, you know, that whole, you know, communication thing is, you know, just being honest and, you know, because just by delaying the whole thing, I mean, it's just as it's just going to be very costly to everybody, you know.
Right.
So
yeah.
There's really, it sounds like there are ways around this. So again, great topic. Again, we haven't done a show like this in 2 years, you know, but I'm glad we did it, you know, and so you did a good job. We have, what do we have next week? We have I Sold It, William Fickman, and he's one of the youngest franchisees, I don't want to say ever in the history of franchising, but he's pretty young, and I think he owns actually several I Sold It franchises, so that's going to be interesting, and I'm actually going to meet him personally. In Chicago, I'm doing a presentation on franchising, and he's going to actually be there. He's won this big competition for something, so very
wow.
successful entrepreneur, yeah, so I'm looking forward to having William on the show, and I know you got a busy week, so I'll let you go, Don, and we'll talk next week.
Okay, have a good day, Marty.
You too, Don. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.